the whole concept of business cycles. Well, first of all, before the mid-18th century, there weren't no such thing as a business cycle, except maybe in Italian cities or something like that, but in a very localized scale. But basically what you had, William Scott, I think, wrote a book some years ago, some decades ago, about business annals, about going through all the annals of business and seeing what happened from year to year, prosperity and depression kind of situation. They find out that the business cycles were something, or business developments were something like this. Everything goes along sort of smoothly, and then bingo. Or everything goes along sort of smoothly, and so there's no real business cycle. What happens is there are individual events, usually that mess things up. For example, the king will decide, the king needs money, the king decides to nationalize, confiscate all the money of the goldsmiths. This causes headaches. Or a war begins and all trade is cut off or something, and obviously there's a big depression, or there's a big, some kind of crazy boom comes in. The point is, there's no real regularity in any, or any kind of boom-bust kind of cycle. All individual events, all of which can be traced to some kind of individual, a clear, evident cause, like the king nationalizes, or there's a war that cuts off trade. But for example, even later, much later than this, when the Civil War begins, the English cotton textile industry, which was dependent on American cotton, suddenly gets cut off from supply. Obviously, there's a big depression in the English cotton textile industry. They later turned to other sources, but the point is, for a while, they kind of caught short. I mean, so it's obvious why these things happen and how they create problems. But there was never any idea, really, of some kind of a boom-bust which follows each other in any kind of regular pattern, and which can't be, where there's no evident cause. But you can't say, okay, this is a tulip bubble, or this is something else. Something is happening which is not self-evident to the average observer. This begins to happen in the mid-18th century, especially in Britain, in the most industrialized countries, in the most developed countries. And you get a sort of a boom-bust pattern, okay, something like that. And from then on, economists and other observers tried to understand, why is this happening? Why is this new development? It's a development that's not very welcome, especially the bust part. Everybody loves the boom part. Nobody's really worried about the boom, but everybody's really concerned when there's suddenly a bust. And particularly the crisis or the panic, when banks fail and every bankruptcies occur and things are falling and you don't know what's going on. The sudden crisis, the sudden panic. So the older historians, for example, refer only to the panic of 1837 or whatever, and not any kind of business cycle. Really interested in this panic problem. Well, what happens is two things really happen. Two big things happen in the mid-18th century, and they happen together. I mean, they happen around the same time. This confuses economists who try to analyze the cause. The two big things are the Industrial Revolution and the development of the modern banking system. What happens is you have a general split or two kinds of business cycle theories which then develop ever since. One of which centers the cause on something that happens deep within the industrial system, some malfunction which is inherent in industrialism or capitalism or whatever. And the other group pinpoints the cause as something in the banking system that screws up the situation. And obviously if it's the banking system, then it's a much easier thing to cure, because then you sort of and clobber the banks in somewhere or the other. It's a much simpler thing to get at. If it's something that's deep within the industrial system or the capitalist system, then you've got a lot of troubles in your hand. Then you can get people like Marx who say you have to scrap the whole business and go over to socialism. Well, so you have these two competing tendencies, say, among economists from then on. The interesting thing is, well, what happens in the 20th century economics, before the Friedmanites came in big number. Basically, not only did the industrial side win out, the idea that industry is the cause win out, but the people who claimed that banks are really the cause were confused with being simplistic. That's always a big thing, because it's too simple. You have to have really complicated, to be respectable, you have to have a very complicated analysis of what's going on. So the accusation of being simplistic stuck very, hit very deep. Managed to squelch a lot of the monetary kind of argument. Another thing is this is a very peculiar thing in history of economic thought. What happens is that the founders of modern scientific economics, if you want to put it that way, David Ricardo and his group, really had a monetary explanation of the business cycle. But if you look at histories of economic thought, you never find this. Just disappear. It's been plunked down the memory hole. What happens is, everybody says, yeah, Ricardo had and David Hume before him, had a theory of international trade. The theory of international trade essentially goes something like this. International trade and the price level. This is the so-called gold specie flow mechanism, another term for it. Let's say he had a bunch of countries, England, France, Germany, whatever. England inflates the money supply. The banks inflate the money supply. To the aegis of government. This is almost always the case. All right, banks increase the money supply. As the money supply goes up in England, prices go up because of the direct relationship between money and the price level, prices in general. So prices are dragged up along with it. As English prices go up, certain things happen. Now we find, for example, one thing, English prices are now no longer competitive with French and German prices. They're competing for world markets. English prices are too high. So this means that the French cut down their imports from England. So English exports decline. And while this is going on, the English prices are too high. Englishmen, now fueled with more money, they think they have more money from the banks, and also looking around and finding out that other prices are cheaper, buy more from France and Germany and the United States and whatever. So imports go up. So the direct result of this inflationary situation in England, with money supply going up, bank money going up, and then prices going up, is that we have exports falling, imports going up, so-called deficit in the balance of payments. How are you going to pay for the deficit? Well, there's only one way to pay for the deficit. In those good old days, there's no such thing as gold exchange standard and all monkeying around with foreign currency reserves. You pay for it with gold. And because the French and the Germans are not going to take anything except gold. They're not interested in sitting on a hoard of pounds. It's only now in a more sophisticated age when these tomfool Germans and Japanese, etc., are sitting on $80 billion worth of dollars, which they can't do anything with. In those days, they were more hard-headed. So they insist on gold, so they have to ship gold out. Well, you keep shipping gold out, you're into a sort of a crisis, particularly if you have a banking system which you're paying in gold. In other words, you know, or silver, let's say gold, make it simpler, the main situation in the 19th century anyway. You have to pay in gold, you're issuing bank notes or bank deposits, you have to pay in gold. As you keep multiplying banknotes, here in this kind of situation, here's the bank. The banks are, let's say, 10 to 1 or 5 to 1, whatever the ratio is, of notes and deposits on top of gold. They're expanding their notes and deposits, so they're increasing the top part of the pyramid. And as a result of that, they're losing gold, so the bottom part keeps dropping. So they're getting more and more top-heavy. And as they get more and more top-heavy, they get more and more scared. They're getting a situation with increasing demand by the French and the Germans, etc., for redemption in gold. In the meantime, the Englishmen start getting a little nervous, because here you are, your bank depositor, your bank note holder. You look at the balance sheet and you find out the supply of gold is getting less and less proportionately to those in the policy. You start cashing in. I'm going, you know, why should I wait until the crisis? Let's start cashing in now. This is a great concept of the bank run, by the way. A noble bank run. where you begin to realize down deep in your heart that the bank is really bankrupt. See? They haven't got the money that they say they've got, and you really sort of thought they had, but you really knew down deep they don't have it. So you start, I'm going to be the first, I'm not going to wait. I'm going to, you know, pull cash in, and your friends do it, and your relatives do it, and pretty soon the panic is on. So all these things are pressuring in on the banking, on the English banks, let's say. And finally the crisis occurs, the English banks are forced to contract that credit. They have to stop it. There's bank runs, there's guys calling in from abroad and internally. And then you get the contraction of the money supply. And as the money supply contracts, you have bankruptcies and panics, and you have calling in loans, and everybody's in very bad shape for a while. It's a crisis. And then the prices fall, as a result of the fall in money supply. As the prices fall, we begin to have a reversal of the deficit of the balance of payments. This is the deficit. We're going to have a situation as English goods are getting cheaper now, English exports go up, and English imports go down. Imports from England, now there's not as much incentive to buy from abroad, and anyway, people haven't got the money to buy from abroad that they did before. So now there's a surplus in the balance of payment, the money flows back in, and we have a double regulatory mechanism here, so to speak. We have, on the one hand, a self-regulatory feedback, so to speak, and a balance of payments. limiting the deficits. You can't have a, I mean, now we have like a permanent deficit. We have a deficit at least for 23 years, we'll continue to have it. So in those days, what you have in the gold standard mechanism, you have this limiting situation. You have a limit on inflation, and you have a limit on deficit balance of payments. You have this regulatory kind of device. And it's also a device that keeps price levels more or less proportionally throughout the world trading area. So no one country gets out of line with other countries' prices. It's a beautiful system. However, it works less well the more banking inflation you have and muck things up, and the more the regulatory mechanism gets slowed down by government action. So anyway, this is what every textbook talks about, this Ricardian, Hume-Ricardo species form mechanism. What they don't talk about is that at the same time the Hume-Ricardo adumbrate theory of species flow price level, they also have a theory of business cycle. It's a fairly simple theory, but it's a pretty damn good one. The theory is the banks inflate money and credit, prices go up, you have a boom, everybody's feeling good, they spend more, et cetera, and then finally the banks have to contract credit, then you have prices collapsing, et cetera. This is a one-stage, two-phase business cycle, so to speak, one unit, two-phase business cycle. Well, you might ask, what's one of the questions is, okay, let's say this explains one unit. Why does it keep on going like this? It's not strictly periodic, but, you know, it's sort of a regular kind of pattern. And the reason is, this is again, part of the theory, banks always want to inflate. They always want to expand money and credit. They haven't been able to get away with it here because everything is sort of zeroed in on them. What happens is after a couple of years of shaking out, everybody's sort of forgotten about this, the banks are back in a sound liquid condition, then they can start the process up again and the whole thing begins once more. And this, of course, added to this is the tendency of the government to inflate for reasons I think mentioned before. The government always wants to have more money either to pay for its own expenses or to subsidize favored groups. And the best way to get it is to have the banks inflate the money supply. So this is the Ricardian model. This is the first big monetary theory of the business cycle, emphasizing money in the banks as the major cause. Obviously, I can't prove any of this in these lectures here. I have to refer you to my other writings I recommended. But the point is, this is sort of the basic model. You had a big fight interestingly enough, in the early 19th century, the United States, everybody thinks of American economic thought as being very backward compared to English. In the United States, they had one shrewd realization. I think Professor McGoldrick was mentioning that notes and deposits are really the same. The English economists, even though they're much more intelligent, much more high-type than the American economists, never really realized until it was too late that bank notes and demand deposits, checking accounts, are the same thing. Economically, they're both part of the money supply. They concentrated on the bank notes and refused to... They said, no, demand deposits are something else. They're legitimate. They're not part of the money supply. And they got the whole thing fouled up as a result. And when the Ricardians, who were called the currency school, and they passed the Noble Peel's Act of 1844, designed to smash the business cycle once and for all, by requiring 100% deposit, 100% gold back to any future inflation of banknotes. In other words, if you have you allow this 10-to-1 to keep on for purposes of so to ease the transition period, you say any further increase in notes, has to be backed by the same amount of gold. To impose a non-inflationary forevermore on the English banking system, they left out the deposits because they didn't think deposits were part of the money supply. And what happens then is the banks start another inflation based purely on its checking accounts. And this discredits the whole currency school, because everybody says, you see, some of the banks will be, business cycle will be stopped by the Peel's Act, and it didn't work. So the whole currency school is discredited forevermore. Yeah? Sure.
I didn't understand it when you threw it in the
Right.
By, I'll make sure I got this straight now, by deposits or demand deposits, you mean what some people call checking.
Right. Right. Check button money, right. The thing is that this is a very simple kind of thing, which this again this is a point where all economists agree on this particular point I mentioned, but many people here might not know it. Let's suppose there's only one bank in the country, even one bank in the entire world. This eliminates all deficits of balance of payments. There's now one world government, let's say. Let's assume this. There's one world bank, the bank of the world. Okay. There's no, and there's a compulsory monopoly of a banking system, no competition. We have the bank of the world. Okay, the bank of the world, then, supposing there's a reserve requirement, well, it doesn't have to be, supposing there's no reserve requirement. How does the money get created? Well, it gets created very simply. You have supposing there's gold for some reason still an anachronism, say 1 billion in the asset column. This might be, let's say it's lost, let's say you start with 100% reserves, to make it very simple. And here you have demand deposits and notes. Let's say demand deposits for a minute. Let's assume here another model. Everybody, the way they got the gold is by everybody deposited $1 million worth of gold. Everybody gets a checking account matching it. So you have $1 billion on one side, $1 billion on the other. This is essentially the original Bank of Hamburg and Bank of Amsterdam were 100% gold banks. They just sort of like warehouses. You deposit the gold, you get a warehouse receipt, and you have 10 ounces of gold there. You can pick it up anytime you want. And you trade the 10 ounce warehouse receipts back and forth. So let's say on top of the this is non-inflationary. You have instead of having $1 billion of gold in your pocket, you now have $1 billion of gold in the bank, and you have a checking account of $1 billion to represent it. There's been no increase in money supply, still $1 billion. Now the bank of the world starts going on its true purpose, which is to inflate to kingdom come. What it does is it lends $5 billion to General Dynamics for good and useful purposes. Okay? And what it does is, how does it get the $5 billion? It gets it by creating it out of thin air. This is the fundamental law of banking economics, again agreed upon by all the schools of thought in economics, is the banks do not simply borrow your money and re-lend it, they create it. They create it by simply writing out an account, saying, okay, you now have a demand deposit of $5 billion, and the General Dynamics takes the $5 billion and spends it on new factories and so on, hiring workers, etc., etc. And offsetting this now is an IOU from General Dynamics of $5 billion. We now have an increase of the money supply from $1 billion to $6 billion. It's a six-fold increase simply by magic, just writing out this account, opening up the account. Is there any clinker in this? There's only one clinker. What happens is we have a demand deposit at the General Motors of $5 billion. Then General Motors spends it on all sorts of stuff, roads, paper clips, wages, workers, and the $5 billion gets diffused throughout the system. So that now I have a portion of it, you have it, the Litton Industries has it, whatever. So the total is still the $5 billion. The total is expanded, inflated money. The only possible clinker for the Bank of the World is in great shape. They just sextuple the money supply. The only possible problem is some of you guys might want to claim gold or cash or whatever it is for the demand deposits. Then there might be in some trouble. So if one of you has $1 billion, you go to the say $2 billion. You have $2 billion, you go to the bank for redemption. Then the bank is in a little bit of trouble. Where are they going to get the money? And this is the only check on the Bank of the World. Of course, the next step is to eliminate the gold standard, declare the Bank of the World legal tender. So that anything the bank does can't be redeemed, and you're home free. You can inflate forever. Okay, so the banking system, of course, you don't have a Bank of the World. You have all sorts of thousands and thousands of banks in each country. And each bank competes with the other, and each country competes with the other. But the system, but if you can get all these banks to, so the only check, for example, the English banks, I was saying before, that the French banks call on them for redemption, plus the internal Englishmen, that's not very great. But if you can mobilize the whole system, like the Federal Reserve System mobilizes the whole country, if you can mobilize the whole system, so the banks don't really compete, so they're all getting reserves together and all induced to inflate together, then you don't have to worry about one bank cashing in another bank, because you'll have just as many people of the other bank trying to redeem from the first bank, and everybody's hotsy-totsy. The clearinghouse settles the whole business. You can keep inflating forever. So the only problem becomes this redemption. Now, during the free banking period before the Civil War, it's often been said that the wildcat banks expanded. I mentioned before, the reason why the bank, as much inflation as there was, which wasn't really that great before the Civil War, is because every time the banks really got into trouble on a massive scale, the state or federal government said, okay, you don't have to pay anymore for a while. You don't have to pay in gold. This permits the inflation to continue. One amusing thing is that in 1920, there's a correspondence between David Ricardo, the most eminent economist in the world, and Condi Raguet, who was an excellent economist in his own right from Philadelphia, who was a hard money man. And Condi Raguet is trying to explain to Ricardo the American banking situation and having a great deal of difficulty. And he's saying it's terrible, everything's inflated, and the banks are still, they're increasing the money supply, and nobody can redeem any money in gold and so forth. Ricardo's running back and says, what do you mean they can't redeem in gold? It's illegal, you can't The banks can't insist on somebody paying them their debt and then not pay their own debt. How can they get away with it? Why are they still in operation? Why haven't they all been closed up? This is nonsense. So Raguet writes back to him and says, look, Mr. Ricardo, you're a great economist, we love you and so forth, but you don't understand the American banking system. In the United States, everybody is either a bank director or a stockholder, or he owns money to the banks anyway, and or he's dealing business with the banks in some way. So if any outsider wanders into the situation, is not in one of these categories, and tries to redeem his money to the banks, he's immediately clobbered by everybody. He's lynched, he's driven out of town, and so on. So Ricardo was apparently never able to figure this out, dealing with lawless America. At any rate, so this is the what happens with the Peel's Act people. The currency school thinks that the demand deposits are not really money, it's only bank notes. Bank notes is one form of warehouse receipt, and bank deposits are another. Conde Raguet and the American hard money people, the American Ricardians, Bill William Googe and people like that, understood it. They understood the demand deposits were part of the money supply, but they couldn't influence the Ricardians because the Ricardians wouldn't pay any attention to American economists. Who are these clucks over there? We're the big shots. So there was no influence of American economists on the English economists, even though there was, of course, the other way. So they're never able to get it through their skulls until it was too late and the whole jig was up. Well, the next step in this process, in the theoretical front, first essentially made by Knut Wicksell, great founder of Swedish economics, and then by Ludwig von Mises, and the readings which I've commended to you, you add on to this model, this model of the money and prices going up and down as being the key, to something else. And something else makes the business cycle much tougher in a sense of being more intractable once it gets started. Something else is a process of inflating the money supply, inflating bank credit. You're not only raising prices, that's bad enough, you're also doing something else which is even, in a sense, even worse. You're messing up the whole production system. You're messing up the sort of things which business will invest in. You're distorting the whole production process and creating a necessity of a later recession to correct it. So now we begin to have a situation where in this model, you sort of look at the, in a way you can look at the recession as unnecessary. If the government somehow stabilizes the whole thing, and irons it out, you wouldn't have any problem. But if you look at the boom as essentially not just a happy time before the recession, but as really the worst time, because this is the boom is the time where you have the distortion of production, then it's important to allow the recession its head, allow the recession to iron out and correct these distortions as quickly as possible, so you can get this thing over with and go back to a normal kind of pattern. The distortions are for inflationary bank credit, are essentially overinvestment in the capital goods industries, or in the so-called remote orders of production, or the higher orders of production, as the Austrians put it. In other words, things like dams, machine tools, construction, those things which are most remote from consumer goods. And these are the things which get overinvested. In other words, there's an underinvest because of the fact that the banks are expanding and inflating credit. They're pushing the rate of interest below this free market rate. They're creating a situation where too much is invested in the higher orders of production, machine tools and industrial raw materials, et cetera, and not enough in consumer goods. You have this distortion. So that when the bank, and you have to keep doing this, you have to keep inflating, keep one step ahead of retribution, which is, of course, coming up and imposing what is now called a liquidity crisis in industry, where you think you can borrow another 10 million, you can't do it, and how are you going to pay for this extra cost? So once this process stops, once this inflationary process stops, then these distortions are revealed. We find out the business is overinvested in all these projects and all these plants, and the whole thing has to be liquidated as quickly as possible to get workers and resources and equipment back to the consumer goods industry to start in on a sound situation. That's in very brief terms the Austrian theory. What it does is it imposes upon government its policy conclusions are very simple. Its policy, even though the theory might be fairly complex, its policy conclusion is it says to the government, if you're inflating, stop it. And if you're in a recession, don't do anything and let the thing iron out as quickly as possible. In other words, a very, very extreme laissez-faire policy in this area. In the 1920s, this is reflected, as we'll see next time, in a overinvestment in capital goods industries, particularly those areas which reflect know, the value of capital and the stock market and land, which are purely capital, you know, oriented kind of things. Incidentally, on the this is the exact opposite sort of explanation as the usual popular explanation for the depression or the Keynesian explanation of depression. The usual explanation is, all of a sudden you're in a situation, you're in this panic setup, all of a sudden you find retailers and businessmen, they can't sell their product. And so the big cry is, underconsumption. Consumers don't have enough money to pay for the, you know, the hula hoops and the Wheaties and that sort of stuff. Or you can say there's overproduction. Somehow we've produced too much. This is the NRA kind of thing. We have to cut down production and so forth, and systematically chopping up the pigs and all that sort of stuff, slaughtering the pigs. So they did, they slaughtered pigs. Reduced production is too much, that caused a recession. If you look at it, the whole thing is a series of nonsense fallacies involved in all this. The idea that you can have overproduction when half the people are starving is pretty absurd. There will never be overproduction until we reach the Garden of Eden, if we ever do. Until then, there's always scarcity, as far as I've been talking about, the abundance versus scarcity thing. There ain't no such thing as abundance in the technical economic sense. Everything is scarce. If it weren't scarce, its price would be zero. We will find out when the liberal intellectuals are really over affluent, we will discover this when they start burning their salary checks or salary increases. Nobody, as I know of, has been burning their salary increase. When that happens, we can start looking around again. But basically, the point is overabundance is only, the test of overabundance is when everything's free. When you wish for the Pepsi and the Pepsi's pouring down your throat. Can we get to that stage of scarcity? That's the Garden of Eden model. the other thing is under consumption. And that's another very peculiar thing if you look at it. How come the consumers suddenly have less money? Before that, and before October 29 or whatever the thing, 1907, consumers have plenty of money. They're in great shape. All of a sudden, they haven't got any money to spend. That's kind of peculiar too. If you look at that, you find out what the consumers are really saying about this overproduction, underconsumption thing is, it's not that they can't sell their product. It's a lot of nonsense. You can always sell your product. If you invested in too many hula hoops, and the hula hoop craze disappears, and you're stuck with 10,000 hula hoops, and everybody else is off there in the frisbee game, you can get rid of the hula hoops. You can sell them. You can sell them by charging a penny a piece, maybe, or paying people to take it. You can always sell it. The way you sell it is by lowering the price. But that's the one thing they don't want to do, because that would mean they'd be suffering severe losses. So the whole point is not so much that there's underconsumption, but the whole point is, for some reason, businessmen have paid too much. They've bid costs up. They've bought the hula hoops or the frisbees or whatever for a price that turns out to be too high in relation to the price that they can sell it for the next guy down the consumption chain. So for some reason, there's been a cluster of entrepreneurial error. Everybody somehow has bought all this stuff at $10,000 a case, and they can only sell it for $3,000 a case. So the problem is in the price system. Something has happened to screw up the price system. And the problem is overbidding, of course, and the cause for overbidding, of course, is discerned by the Austrian theory, which is that businessmen have been induced by the cheapening of credit and the artificial expansion of credit into the business system to bid up wage rates and bid up costs too high in relation to because of this inflationary credit expansion, too high in relation to what they could be doing, would be getting on the free market when this whole expansion process stops. And finally, another aspect of this underconsumption nonsense is, if you look at any business cycle, including the 1929 depression, you find out the consumption industries are in relatively pretty good shape. I mean, they're less depressed than the construction and machine tool industries. So, for example, retail sales, which everybody, all the papers, you know, you look at they're looking for the business cycle. And the first thing they look at is retail sales. How's the health of the economy? Retail sales are in great shape, so we're doing well. The thing is, retail sales are almost always in great shape. They only, from 1929 to 1933, they fell, I don't know, something like 20%. it fell less than almost anything else. At the same time, manufacturing production, construction was falling by huge amounts, 75%, 90%, 80%, whatever. So the depression always hits what happens, in other words, we look at consumption goods and capital goods industry. The consumption industry boom is something like this, boom bust kind of thing. And the capital goods industry is wildly going up something like that. So there's a much bigger boom in the capital goods industries and a much bigger depression in the capital goods industries, which again bears out the Austrian point. There's overinflation in the capital goods industries, and the whole thing collapses as you readjust back to a free market kind of situation. I may as well conclude with a story here about unions and construction and so forth, which relates to the relationship between wage rates and unemployment, which I'll get to a little later. But anyway, this was told to me by Leo Woolman, my professor, who's extremely expert in all the things in union and labor affairs which don't get published for one reason or another. In this case, we have the construction union, which I said has always been powerful, and with enormous depression in the construction industry. There's been over-construction in New York and every place else in the 20s. As well in Manhattan, where the union is very firm and consists of the boom-level wage rates. But here we are in 1933, and prices have collapsed all over the place, and construction is down almost zero. And the union insists on just as high a wage rate as they had in 1929, which means that the real wage rates, and was wage rates in terms of purchasing power, is way increased. As a result, there's no construction in Manhattan, no buildings, stops. On the other hand, Queens, we have also construction unions. In Queens, the unions were smaller, the employers were smaller, the more personal relationship. They, you know, you'd hire five people instead of 500. So in Queens, there were secret deals between the construction employers and the construction unions, where they'd say, look, they sat down together and said, okay, we realize there's a danger of having no construction at all going on. We can see what's going on in Manhattan, but no buildings being built. So, okay, we can't officially say we will accept a 30% wage cut, let's say. But what we'll do is we'll keep the same wage rate and we'll kick back 30% on the table. And as a result of that, there was a construction, relatively flourishing in Queens. There's only a small drop, or much smaller drop than Manhattan in Queens construction because the unions were willing to accept much lower wage rates under the table because they couldn't break union solidarity, in quotes, officially. Okay, so this sort of introduces the boom-bust theory and money theory. I just want to set the stage for the 20s just for a minute by saying what happens after World War I. The point is that since 1914, the entire international monetary system has been kaput. Basically, it's been a state of advanced decay, desuetude, chaos, etc. The golden age was before 1914, especially from 1815 to 1914, the classical gold standard. And ever since then, we've been trying to get the good parts of the international gold standard without the headaches, without the discipline, so-called, which governments would have to regiment themselves into obeying. So what you have is, essentially after the war, I think I mentioned that all the countries except the United States were off the gold standard because they were all inflated. We now begin to see the hubris of Great Britain. Before World War I, Great Britain was the great center of international monetary affairs, international financial dealing. London was the great center of the heart of the gold standard. But now the pound was depreciated. I think the pound was down to something like $3.50 in 1920. The pound had always been $4.86. This was a classic. The basis was the different weights of gold, the definitions of the dollar and definitions of the pound. It worked out that the dollar was equal to the pound was equal to $4.86. This has been the classic, the whole 19th century, this has been the fixed thing, this is now part of the British heritage. And all of a sudden the pound is down to 350 because the pound had been inflated. I mean, you inflate the currency, the price, its price on the world markets gets cheaper. So now the question is, what would Great Britain do? What do you do about the situation? Here you are, the war is over, the pound is depreciated, and you have several options open to you. One option would have been to cut your losses. This would have been the rational option, by the way. Cut your losses, say, okay, it's too bad, we've inflated, and we have many more pounds in circulation than we had before, and the pound is now 350. We'll go back to the gold standard of 350, and we'll encourage all the other countries to go back at the current level, and we'll start from there. We'll cut our losses. This would have been the rational thing to do. Almost nobody was in favor of it, typically of the rational option. Virtually nobody, maybe one or two economists, maverick economists here and there, said, this is really the easiest thing to do, the simplest, you have less headaches. No, this is out. So that option is crossed out, going back to gold at the new levels. So that's one option. That's crossed out. That doesn't even get consideration, much less any kind of serious study. The consideration was adopted was the idea of going back at the old level. Going back at the old 486, because Britain, British heritage is now 486, we can't accept the devalued pound, this is a terrible thing, and our credit will be doomed, and so on. So you have this quixotic decision to go back at 486. There's a third plan. This is the plan of the left-wing crazy, so to speak, in those days, at least they're considered in those days, of abandoning gold altogether and just go over to fiat currency. This is a minority, much bigger than the rational minority, I must admit, but not very strong yet. Okay, so we go back at 486. When they go back at 486, by the way, the guy who does it, I mean, the guy who was Chancellor of the Exchequer in 1925, I guess it was, when the thing was finally completed, the Chancellor of the Exchequer at the time was Winston Spencer Churchill, who ranks, in my personal values, you know, somewhere along there with Woodrow Wilson and Herbert Hoover. At any rate, Winston Churchill, is one of these guys. Yes, we have to go back at 486. John Maynard Keynes writes, as far as I'm concerned, the only good thing he ever wrote, which is a little pamphlet called The Economic Consequences of Winston Churchill, pointing out predicting what was going to happen. You're going to get a fantastic mess because of this insistence of going back at the old 486 par. So now the Britons decide to go back at 486. What does this mean? How can you go back at 486? It means that now the British pound, even though its goods are priced essentially at 350 everywhere, it means the price of British goods will be astronomic compared to other markets. I mean, the British exports will be frozen out of world markets. I mean, it's really sort of a quasi-lunatic kind of policy. So, especially due to the fact that England lives off imports. I mean, England's a very small country, and they import food and so forth and so on. And their major exports were coal and textiles and shipbuilding. And these were sort of declining industries anyway. I mean, these are industries which are pretty well, not exactly have had it, but I mean, the hand is on the horizon for coal and textiles and shipbuilding. But at any rate, in those days, they're still pretty strong. So England has to have cheap export. I mean, it has to have a competitive kind of export system. But here we are imposing this enormous burden on the export industries. We're saying that the coal and the textiles and the ships are going to be priced now at something like 30% higher than they were before this whole policy goes into effect. So Britain has this problem. They're committed to this 486 nonsense. They're committed at very high prices. What can they do about it? How can they survive? As a matter of fact, what happens is that during the 1920s, when every other economy was booming, United States, Europe, Britain's economy was depressed. Britain had a 20-year depression. Because Britain has very heavy, the exports weren't going, and they had very heavy unemployment in the export industries. So what do you do about it? Well, several things. Given this insane matrix here, the rest of the British policy is extremely cunning and Machiavellian to the hilt. I mean, within an unworkable policy, they did the best they could. So what do you do? First of all, they couldn't. The classical policy would have been to deflate. I mean, the 19th century policy is, all right, you want to go back at 46, our prices are now 30% higher than the competitive, we force the price level down 30% by lowering the money supply by 30%. We put the economy through a deflationary ringer. Now, that would have been done in the old days. They couldn't do it in the 20s because they felt they couldn't do it, because now we have, after World War I, we have a very strong unionized system, bolstered in Britain, bolstered by a big unemployment insurance, national unemployment insurance scheme. So that means any worker that strikes can zip over the unemployment insurance bureau and get his pay from then on. So it was impossible to deflate. They felt that we would have been, you know, like 90% unemployment, because wage rates would have been up there. So they felt it was politically impossible. If they had the guts to do it, if they had a really strong laissez-faire Tory type, they could have done it, perhaps. But anyway, they felt they couldn't do it. All right. There's a lot of labor unrest and general strikes and all that. And so they figured they couldn't deflate, and they couldn't not go back at 486 because of their cookie original decision. So what can they do about it? They wanted to keep inflating, as a matter of fact. They want to continue to have cheap money and inflate some more and get around union wage rates that way. So here they did. They wanted to inflate, so not deflate. They want to go back at 486. How can they manage this? Well, basically in two ways. One, getting everybody else to go back to the gold standard at an overvalued drachma, or whatever it is. In other words, if you're in Bulgaria and your currency is a bulgar, the thing is that Britain had total political control of Europe by this time through the League of Nations, which was essentially a British outfit. The Financial Committee of the League of Nations is run by the British Bank of England. And so what you do is you send experts beaming into Bulgaria and Greece and Latvia and every other place you can get your mitts on. And you tell them, we want you to go back to the gold standard. None of this fiat money, none of this other thing here. We want you to go back to the gold standard, a very highly overvaluated drachma or bulgar or whatever that currency is. So in other words, you can force Bulgaria to go back at the old par. That means the Bulgarian exports are now in big trouble, and English exports to Bulgaria are now cheaper. So in other words, the British policy then becomes this cunning Machiavellian policy of getting all the other European countries to overvalue their currency and go back to the gold standard at that level, and to work out a system with the United States, so-called gold exchange standard, which I'll talk about tomorrow night, and use the United States as sort of the patsy in this whole situation, and then induce the United States through various sinister means to inflate also, because there's also the danger of England losing gold to us. If we kept inflating, we kept our inflation in pace with the English inflation, then Britain could not have to lose gold. So during the whole 1920s, the whole international monetary picture is a series of shoring up measures to help Britain, help Britain get out of the consequences of the decision to go back in 486. And we'll go on to that tomorrow. All right. Thank you. Okay, back to the 1920s inflation. One point before again, exactly into the 20s, I was talking about the Austrian business cycle theory. I should have made it clear that when I said there were two types of theories, causal theories, the banking, the money and banking on one hand, and rooting it in industry in the other, I was placing myself in the Austrian theory in the monetary camp. In other words, an explanation that explains business cycles as being generated through this kind of banking, bank credit inflation. The idea being that all sorts of fluctuations could take place in the free market. A seven-year locust industry, for example. Locust comes every 7 years, and it's not much for the seven-year locust fighting industry to do the other 6 years. They sort of go out of business, and they fade into something else. The seventh year comes along, they're back in business again. So there are fluctuations, but there's no need for them to be general across the whole system and mess up the whole, cause great unemployment and bankruptcy. And it should be fairly predictable in that sense. So in the capital, remember I said the capital goods industries are fluctuating much more intensively, much greater degree than the consumer goods industry. So this means that in the recessions, what's really going on here is the capital goods industries are collapsing, and their prices are going down much further than the capital goods industries than they are in the consumer goods industries. And this shift of price behavior serves to readjust resources, land, labor, and capital, back from the overinvested capital goods industries into the consumer goods industries. So in other words, it induces a reshuffling of resources. Now this means then that, let's say consumer goods prices go down by 20%, a big depression, and machine tool prices go down by 45%. What's really happening here is the consumer goods prices are going up relative to other prices. So in other words, the idea that consumer goods are rising in a recession is not really a new thing. It really happens in every recession. The reason why nobody's seen this until fairly recently is this. In every other recession until 1958, every classical recession, there's also been a contraction of the money supply. And the money supply had a one-shot model here. So the money supply goes up and boom and collapses and depression and there's a bank credit contraction. As that happens, the whole ball of wax is moved downward. So the oil prices are falling. And in this sort of example, consumer goods prices falling by 15-20%, capital goods prices falling by 45%. So the consumer, when he's looking at this, he's satisfied in the sense that at least consumer goods prices are falling. But relative to other prices, consumer goods prices are going up. But this situation is masked, so to speak, or offset by the fact that oil prices are falling due to this monetary contraction. So the Austrian business cycle theory explains the reason why consumer goods prices go up relatively to other prices. What's happened is starting in 58, really starting in the 30s, when you get right down to it, the inflation of the 30s took place, prices were going up in the middle of a big depression. It starts in 58 again, and then 69, 71, where prices, consumer goods prices particularly keep going up. One of the explanations for this is that there is now the rule, the political rule in the United States of bank credit, money supply and bank credit shall never be allowed to fall again. Well, if the money supply can't fall ever again, this means the price level won't fall ever again. And so the price level this process of the whole price level of flooring, which is masked, this process is now removed. You know, the veil is taken off. You strip away one veil, you find out by God, consumer goods prices are going up in a recession. It's a monstrous thing. But it's been happening all the time, but its effects have been offset by deflation. This is one of the great things about deflation. The great thing about deflation is, the good thing about a depression is the prices fall. I mean, from the point of view of the consumer, which is should be the general point of view. My father, for example, those who happened to be employed during the Great Depression were doing pretty well. And my father's most prosperous time his entire life was during the Great Depression of the 30s, because he happened to continue to be employed and prices were collapsing and he bought all his furniture then and so forth and so on. So, but now we have a situation due to the Keynesian, the wise measures of the Keynesian economics and the various Democratic and Republican administrations. We now have a situation where every time we have a recession, we won't be able to enjoy falling prices. The prices are going to keep going up. We're going to suffer the worst of both worlds, so to speak. We're going to have bankruptcies and unemployment, et cetera, and falling production and prices going up. It's going to be a beautiful system. beautiful system to look forward to. So this essentially is what happens. But neither the Keynesian nor the Friedmanite business cycle theories have any explanation for this at all. And it's only the Austrian theory in terms of the consequences on the micro system, so to speak, of the macro movements. As a matter of fact, this is a favorite story which I've repeated at least a dozen times or so, which I'll repeat again because it fits in. Great story. One of my professors at Columbia when I was going to graduate school was Arthur F. Burns. In those days, he was a high theorist and not interested in politics. And he was tapped by the Rockefeller Axis, and when Eisenhower became president, he became the chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors. And when he left, incidentally, it's interesting what happens to a professor, enters government, because before he left for Washington, his lectures were fantastic, brilliant theoretical analyses of Keynes and Chamberlain and Robinson and all the rest of it. And when he gets back from the government after several years in the head of the Council of Economic Advisors, his lectures consist of story anecdotes about what he said to Eisenhower, what Eisenhower said to him, what he said to Rockefeller, and so forth and so on. Sort of an anecdotal history of his life. And at any rate, he gives us these series of lectures just when the recession of 58 was hitting, which was the first time it was officially recognized we had this peculiar phenomenon of an inflationary recession. An inflationary recession violates all the rules, all the Keynesian rules and all the Friedmanite rules, because what you're supposed to be doing in a recession, according to the Keynesians, when you see a recession, you pump spending into the system, get deficits, pump spending in, prime the pump, et cetera, and lift the economy up. But at least in the old Chicago school theory, you pump money into the system. You don't bother with spending, you concentrate on the money supply, and you pump that in. And the eclectic types who don't want to choose between Keynesianism and Chicagoism say you pump both in. You may as well push both stops. You pump in spending and you have deficits and why not? You have deficits and increase in inflation. And then what you're supposed to do in the boom, you see inflation running away, you go to the other set of dials and you say, okay, now we pull spending out of the system by raising taxes or we contract the money supply or whatever. So all of a sudden, here we have a situation, but all this sort of contrast cyclical policies, it's called, rests on a couple of key assumptions, one of which is that all things are moving in the same direction. In other words, that during a boom, prices are going up and spending is going up, etc. And during a recession, prices are falling and you have bankruptcies and unemployment. So Burns was outlining this whole doctrine. I was supposed to be a neutral observer of this thing. I couldn't refrain from plunging into the situation, as my want. So I said, well, Professor Burns, this is during the question period, what happens if you continue to have this inflationary recession? And what happens, what policies would you advocate for in a recession and prices are going up and unemployment is, everything else is falling, unemployment is increasing, etc. So he says, well, it's not going to happen now because we're pulling, 58 recession is almost over and 2 months we'll be out of it, so no real problem. And I said, okay, conceding that, what would you advise if sometime in the future we will have an inflationary recession? And he stops a minute and he says, well, he says, he speaks like W.C. Fields without the humor. This is Lee. He says, well, he says, in that case, we don't have to resign. he hasn't resigned, of course. Nobody resigned during this. But that was an admission of the fact that these people really have no answer to the current setup. Okay, back to the 1920s. I think that's another rule a forest would concede. Another rule of bureaucracy: nobody ever resigns. I mean, it's like once in a million, somebody actually gets out. Stevenson used to call it boring from within or something, or complaining. okay, so we have England in this pickle, as I was talking about. Okay, England then sets out on its grand design of conning, bludgeoning, whatever, all the other countries to inflate, European countries to go back to the gold standard, overvalue zloty or whatever the currency is, and the United States to play along with the system. The grand British plan was unfolded at the Genoa Conference of 1922, which is very little known in the textbooks. It was one of the key events in modern 20th century monetary history. It was engineered, the theoretics of it was worked out by a Mephistophelian economic theorist working for the Bank of England, Sir Ralph Fortrey, a very distinguished economist, works out the essentials of this plan. The big clout, the person running the English monetary system during this whole period, was the head of the Bank of England, Montague Norman, a key figure in this whole business. Montague Norman used to have, here really the conspiracy theory works beautifully, I mean almost acknowledged by everybody dealing with this whole thing. Norman. Because what happened was Norman and Benjamin Strong had a constant series of secret conferences, and they really were secret, because Strong didn't want the Washington authorities to find out about it. There was a certain suspicion of England among the Midwest masses, and so forth. And Washington liked this whole, Washington was upset, and they didn't know what's going on here. So Strong and Norman have secret conferences, and what they do every year, every 6 months, Ben Strong would sort of stretch his arms one day, stretch his shoulders, and say, "Well, fellas, I'm pretty tired. I think I'm going up to Saratoga for vacation." And he'd go up to Saratoga for vacation. He'd check in at the big hotel there. Meantime, Norman would zip over, not telling anybody in the press. He would come over to the same hotel in Saratoga, and he'd register as Professor Skinner for some reason. I didn't check up about why he used this alias, Professor Skinner. Nothing to do with psychologist Skinner. And he registers Professor Skinner, and they have these secret talks, and then Norman slips out in the middle of the night, and Strong slips back. And so there's a very strong connection. Most historians interpret this, and I did a little bit myself, of Norman is exerting a sort of Svengali personal influence on Strong. Well, that might have been some of that involved. But one of the things which is usually overlooked, of course, is, you can hear it now, and say this in unison, is the influence of the Morgans. Benjamin Strong, I've already said, was virtually a Morgan representative in this whole thing. With Montague Norman, first of all, the J.P. Morgan Company continues to be the fiscal agent for the Bank of England during this whole period. I mean, they acknowledge fiscal agent. And second of all, Montague Norman came from an old international banking family. He was a former partner of the London investment banking firm Brown Shipley and Company, which was the New York branch or whatever, Brown Brothers Company in New York, the great international banking firm, investment banking firm. And he personally had worked in Montague Norman had worked in Brown Brothers and Company in New York for several years, and his grandfather had been a partner of the firm. There's a whole tradition in the family. Brown Brothers later, of course, becomes Brown Brothers Harriman, and was in many ways associated with the House of Morgan in this in international banking consortium. So we have the Morgan thread running through the charisma, the Svengali influence, and all the rest of it. So reinforcing the two of them, and we'll take our choices of which was the more important. At any rate, so we have the Genoa Conference, 1922, in which England unveils the master plan. The master plan is essentially like this: instead of having before the war. If you see any resemblances between this and Bretton Woods, that's it. It's virtually Bretton Woods prefigured. In the classical gold standards, remember, each country has their own currency, notes and deposits, pyramid on top of gold. So this would be say, pounds, and this will be francs, and so forth. The French would have gold, and the Germans would have marks, and so forth, and so on. So this is the classical gold standard system. Now we have another system invented by England and pushed through the whole world, called the gold exchange standard, a new razzle-dazzle thing which Norman has come up with, Norman and Hawtrey come up with. So instead of having the gold standard, we have the gold exchange standard, which everybody said, well, it'll be the same thing as the old gold standard, same thing, just more economical. We'll economize on reserves. Whenever any banker talks about economizing on reserves, you know, look, head for the hills. It means inflation is coming. So the theory now is, all these other countries, Bulgaria and Greece and Latvia and all the others, supposed to pyramid their stuff, not on their own gold supply. Don't they supposed to have gold anymore? It's obsolete. Send all the gold to Washington and London. That was the concept. So all these other countries, Bulgaria, let's say, has the bulgar, the zloty, whatever the Bulgarian currency is, they're pyramiding Bulgarian notes on deposits on top of now, not gold or not gold, but the pound, the British pound or the dollar. And the same thing happens with Greece and so forth. So you have all these guys, you have, in other words, this whole an international system of all these guys pyramiding notes and deposits on top of the pound. In other words, on top of foreign of sterling reserves, pound sterling reserves, which they hold in London, consisting of, you know, the bank deposits in London or short-term treasury bills. And then also on the pound is supposed to be pyramided on top of dollars. The British are supposed to be holding not really gold so much, but dollars. But these two currencies, these two base currencies, are called the key currencies of the system. So several banks that are told and induced and arms twisted, etc., to take them to, you know, why mess around with gold? Gold is unproductive. Keep your money in London. Keep it in Washington. Keep it especially in London. And it'll be earning interest for you and so forth and so on. What happens, the result of this cunning diabolic scheme is Britain has its deficit in the balance of payments, but nobody, you know, Bulgaria, Romania, Greece, etc., they don't call on Britain to repay in gold anymore because they're using the pounds of the reserves to pyramid their own stuff on top of. So this looks like an endless thing. It looks like a new magic thing, like a perpetual motion machine, as far as mentioned the other day. Boy, oh boy, this is terrific. Britain can inflate as much as they want, and the deficit of the balance of payments, and the money flows out, but instead of the France or Germany or whatever calling upon Britain for redemption, they use these pounds as part of their own money base of money supply. They pyramid on top of that, and Britain can inflate forever and no retribution will ever be subject upon it. This, of course, is what happened with Bretton Woods from 1944 to 1971, except the United States pushes Britain out of the key currency and takes over. It's essentially the same damn thing. And retribution comes eventually, but it takes quite a while. So Keynes' famous statement is that in the long run we're all dead, so we shouldn't worry about the long run. But one of the jokes of history is that we're now in the long run. I mean, Keynes is dead and we're here. We're suffering in the long run. To bolster this idea of the gold exchange standard key currency, of course this is really required, obviously, from it. You tell the public, you don't need any gold coins anymore. Forget gold coins. It's a relic of barbarism. Give it away to your kids at Christmas, maybe, but outside of that, forget it. And so Britain and, of course, these other countries don't redeem their money in gold anymore. They redeem it in gold coins anymore. They redeem it in gold bullion, if they redeem it at all. The idea is leave gold for your international transactions, the big transactions. The gold bullion, the gold bar is what it is. Forrest mentioned gold bar the other day. It's something like $1,100 or whatever. And so you can't break the bar down, you know. I mean, gold coins can be used by everybody in everyday transactions. If you can't redeem money in less than the gold bar, then you're limiting the whole thing to international trade and to big business and so forth. You're taking gold out of the system, in effect. So in addition, as a corollary to gold exchange standard, we have the gold bullion standard. Only the United States remains on gold coins, and we're just trying to discourage it as much as possible. We're laughing. We're trying to sneer at it. Say, you know, okay, you can get gold coins if you want, but it's really, you know, you're really being pretty ridiculous. You're an old rube and you don't understand modern banking and that sort of stuff. But we still were at least nominally on the gold coin standard, and the other countries are now being more sophisticated and were piling everything on top of the dollar and top of the pound. And the third arm of this, as I mentioned, is that Britain is inducing or forcing Bulgaria, Romania, and Greece to go back and overvalue zlotys and overvalue drachmas, etc. in order to hurt their exports and stimulate British exports to those countries. They're able to do, and also, those countries which are too backward to have a central bank, Britain forced them to have a central bank, because if you don't have a central bank, you can't really inflate very well. You can't play your part in the great Genoa Conference game. So Britain controlling Montague Norman and his ally, his agents and theoreticians, controlling the Financial Committee of League of Nations, uses their fantastic political and economic clout to drub all these guys in the line, set up a central bank for them, get them to come back with a gold bullion standard, a gold exchange standard, and an overvalued zloty, etc., etc. Essentially, Britain was running, and then one way or the other, the monetary and financial systems of at least the following countries in Europe: Austria, Hungary, Danzig, Estonia, Greece, Bulgaria, Belgium, Norway, Italy, Portugal, Yugoslavia, Poland, and Romania, virtually all of Europe, with the exception of France, which is going to go back at hard money, but France was induced by British pleading, you know, on their knees, please, you know, don't call on sterling redemption because we, you know, break the whole system. And so France was piling up sterling reserves also. All of this was done, incidentally, with a conjunction of the cooperation and the fraternal blessings of J.P. Morgan and Company, which helped as much as they could in fueling the thing or lending money to the Bank of Yugoslavia to get the thing going and so forth. Okay, but the key to making the thing work was the cooperation of good old Uncle Sap down here. It was the only country that was continuing on the gold coin standard. Supposed to be the basis of this all. And we had to keep inflating. We had to make sure that Britain wasn't losing too much gold to us because of their inflationary policies. We obliged them. As soon as Norman was appointed, as a matter of fact, during World War I, Benjamin Strong sends him a letter hastening the promise of services. So, it's a rather oddly phrased letter, as I remember it. He's almost like, pledging your fealty to your master. pledging his, do everything he can to help him. And in 1920, Norman starts making these annual trips to the United States to see Strong, and Strong makes trips to see Norman, and etc., etc., and they have this a secret thing, and then they trips to Saratoga, and so forth. Well, several big inflationary impetuses in this thing. One of them was, the first big one was 1924, when the Federal Reserve System enters the open market, dictated by Strong, and buys an enormous amount of government securities in order to push down interest rates and inflate the money supply in the United States and keep prices up again. What had happened was, this is supposed to smooth the way for Great Britain. Great Britain was going to go back to gold in 1925, and so we had to inflate to help us smooth this process along. Actually, what had happened was that the pound, after Britain announces the fact we're going back to the pound of 486 in 1925, the pound, of course, shoots up again. It goes back to about $4.70. But in 1923, from 1923 to 1924, the British financial policy was so unsound and was so inflationary that the pound dropped anyway, even though Britain was saying in 1 year we're going back at 486. Still, the value of the pound on the international foreign exchange market drops from $4.70 to $4.32 by mid-1924. So Britain was in very bad shape here. Here's telling everybody, in 1925, we're going back, we've got 486, we forced all these guys to adopt all this stuff, we're in great shape. And here they are, here on the world market, the pound was down at 432. So this is a crisis. So Norman calls on Strong to inflate. Strong inflates, and the British pound strengthens again, goes back up to $4.78 because the United States prices are rising. Actually, the two things involved here. When the Federal Reserve buys government securities in the open market, they're doing two things. One, you're inflating the money supply, the bank deposits, and you're pushing U.S. prices up. You're also at least temporarily pushing down American interest rates. Obviously, the government floods in and buys all this stuff. The demand for bonds goes up, it means interest rates fall. And so you're pushing down interest rates. And when you're pushing down interest rates, much of short-term world capital, at least, and even long-term world capital, depends on, you know, where you can get a higher interest return. If you can get 7% in the United States and 3% in England, there's not too much world capital that's going to remain in England. So you have this tendency toward uniformity. So we also try to push down our interest rates in order to keep Britain from losing gold to the United States. It's a double-pronged thing. And it worked. It worked in the sense that immediately In a few months, the pound strengthens again, goes up to 4.78, and they're ready to go back to the gold exchange standard. I mean, go on to the gold exchange standard. This is a deliberate policy, a strong rights to Andrew Mellon, on May 17, 1924. Andrew Mellon is the Secretary of the Treasury. Of course, we don't have to wonder which interest Andrew Mellon represents, because Andrew Mellon is Andrew Mellon, owns all of Pittsburgh. Okay. Plus the Gulf Oil Company and Alcoa and a bunch of other things. Anyway, Strong writes to Mellon. He says, the burden of this readjustment, by this he means, well, he starts off by saying we have to raise the United States price levels relative to Great Britain, and we have to lower American interest rates relative to Great Britain in order to permit Great Britain to, quote, return the gold, unquote. And really, it wasn't much a return. It was really advancing onto this peculiar new abortion of the system. Anyway, so Strong writes, quote, the burden of this readjustment must fall more largely upon us than upon them, Great Britain. It will be difficult politically and socially for the British government and the Bank of England to face a price liquidation in England. In other words, to take the route of deflating. So it will be difficult politically and socially. In face of the fact that their trade is poor, and they have over a million unemployed receiving government aid. So we're going to do this to help Britain. So, for example, while in 1922 and 1923, American interest rate on American bills in New York was above the rate in London, by mid-1924, the Federal Reserve System had managed to push interest rates in New York below those in London. This checked the gold outflow from London. Also in 1925, the United States, helped by the New York Fed, lends Great Britain a line of credit in gold of up to $200 million, to be there in case they need it at any moment. And J.P. Morgan and Company authorizes a line of credit of $100 million to be subsidized in complicated ways by the Federal Reserve System, also in case the Bank of England needs it. And similar credit by the New York Fed similar lines of credit was extended, again, to permit these countries to come back to this kind of system, to the central banks of Belgium, Poland, and Italy.